Hello and welcome to the Providence College Podcast. I'm your host, Liz Kay, and I'm joined by producer Chris Judge of the class of 2005. Here at the Providence College Podcast, we bring you interesting stories from the Friar family. This week, we're speaking with Dr. Theo Riofrancos, assistant professor of political science. Dr. Riofrancos joined PC's faculty in 2015. Her research focuses on resource extraction, renewable energy, climate change, green tech, social movements, and the left in Latin America. This summer, Duke University Press is publishing her book, Resource Radicals. She was awarded fellowships from the Andrew Carnegie Foundation and the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University for her next project, Brine to Batteries, the Extractive Frontiers of the Global Energy Transition. Dr. Riofrancos, thank you and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us how you first got interested in this topic.
It's a circuitous route, as it often is with research. My prior research focused a lot on the forms of political and social and environmental conflict that arise over extractive projects. So projects that we might more traditionally think of as extractive, like oil and mining and those types of sectors. And I did that research in Latin America. And as I was conducting research and drafting what would be my first book, which is coming out this summer, I also began to realize the connections between climate change on a global level and some of these localized conflicts over resource extraction. And I wanted to think about a project that more clearly connected those two, the pressing issue of climate change and how local communities are affected, and also how national policymaking can kind of mediate between those two things. And so through just kind of reading and thinking and brainstorming, I realized that climate change is going to involve a lot of new technologies to be deployed in order to deal with mitigating climate change and also adapting to a climate change world. And those technologies are familiar to us, solar panels or electric vehicles, things like that. And that those technologies, despite being very environmentally friendly in one sense, in the sense that they help us deal with climate change, address its impacts, they also, like any economic activity, have their own environmental impacts, right? And it turned out that one of the key sources of the environmental and social impacts of producing these green technologies that we need is in the resource extraction, the mining that is required to pull stuff out of the ground in order to create a solar panel. A solar panel doesn't drop from the sky, nor is it just, synthesized like in biochemistry or something, right? It involves physical materials that are taken from the natural environment. And some of those are the same as like the traditional mining sectors that I just mentioned a couple minutes ago, like copper. Copper is like a very long-standing mining sector in the world. Copper is used for all sorts of things, but specifically with green technologies, copper wiring is very important. In all of our, in all of our electronic devices, there's copper wiring. But if you're going to make something like a Tesla, there's a huge amount of copper that goes into that. So some, kind of gleaming, fancy new green technology actually requires a lot of stuff taken out of the earth, and that can create lots of environmental and social impacts, of course, to some degree, depending how it's done. But in some ways, no matter what, if you're mining at a large scale, there's going to be environmental impact. So I decided to zoom in on electric vehicles, but choose a resource sector that was new to me, which is lithium mining. And lithium is an element that's right now 100% essential to rechargeable batteries, which again are in our phones and our laptops and all the stuff that we're using right now, but are in a much more of them is much more lithium is required for something like an electric vehicle, an electric bus, an electric truck, because the batteries, just imagine, are much huger than in our iPhones, right? And so I basically, through my interest in climate change and in combating climate change, and through my kind of pre-existing expertise in resource extraction, the kinds of conflicts it poses, I created a research topic that straddles those areas. That's my sort of circuitous route to how I got to it, but kind of gives you a sense of the different threads that it brings together.
But so essentially, green tech presents this interesting conundrum, as you mentioned. I mean, it might help us get to a more carbon neutral world, but at the same time, there are environmental impacts that represent challenges.
Exactly. And some of those are not just in the extractive phase. That's where I focus and where I think some of the thorniest impacts are. You know, for a local community that's near a lithium mine or a copper mine, you know, for them, it sort of may not matter at all that it's being used to create, you know, green technology that we all need, including that community might need, right? Because the impacts are sort of the same. But, and so I think that's where you get the worst kind of environmental contamination, water kind of issues. But just to bring us a little bit closer to like the consumer side or the end use side, right? There's other environmental impacts. One of them is the fact that many countries, most countries, I should say, in the world, maybe all of them, we could even say, and definitely the US, don't have adequate recycling infrastructure for, certainly for like things like iPhones, but also, again, think of a world in which we all drive electric vehicles, right? And like, what do we do with that sort of toxic electronic waste? Like, because a lithium battery has some, you know, can create, has all sorts of hazards that it can generate once it's disposed of. Like, what are we doing with that? That's one thing. And then another, just, and this is my last, just a little quick example, is this is a little less on the environmental side and more on the kind of social impact side. Building all of these wind farms and solar farms that we need to actually transition to renewable energy also can cause local conflicts, right? Because it may be that a given local community or neighborhood like doesn't want the wind farms right next to obstructing their view of whatever, you know, landscape, or maybe directly impacting the ability to use that land for farming or something else. You know, sometimes those concerns are not really founded in empirical reality. Like, it's not like the wind farm is going to cause, you know, sometimes there are conspiracy theories that it'll cause like a disease or something like that. Those are not true, but it's true that people have real concerns over land use and like how land is used. And also, I think the real takeaway from the research I've read on that type of conflict is that it's important to involve local communities and not just like the decision making, but the economic benefits of that. So there are all these different places sort of thinking about the renewable energy transition that conflicts can arise. And then thinking like through political science literature, sociology literature, and other social sciences, like how can those conflicts be addressed in a way that's equitable and just and feels good for the people that are involved.
I mean, some of the debates over the placement of solar farms, those are happening right here in Rhode Island. I mean, people
For sure. And, you know, it can make a difference in terms of like, is it a private corporation that comes from out of state or in some cases from out of the country and says, we're just going to develop this land and we're going to profit from it. We're going to develop the solar farm and we're going to profit from it. Or, you know, is it, you know, a community owned or municipally owned like wind farm, or does the community have some ownership stake in it? And there's all sorts of research that shows that this actually makes a huge difference in whether communities embrace this, what can be a really big change. And especially if we think of things like how many transmission lines will need to be built to electrify the whole, to really like transition as much as possible to electricity and then make that electricity no carbon. It's a big footprint on the landscape, right? And so kind of at the ground floor, making sure that communities feel involved in the process. And I would say that lesson applies to the construction of wind farms and solar farms and transmission lines, but it also applies to mining, right? You know, at the very early end of the supply chain, like how are communities involved? Are they being consulted? Are the environmental impacts being clearly shown to communities? And so, you know, you could sort of choose lots of places in this process to kind of do the type of research that I'm interested in. I'm zooming in more on the resource extraction end, but I think, you know, there are interesting lessons kind of and ways to think about the whole set of changes that will need to happen with renewable energy.
Because it's going to impact communities all the way down the line.
Exactly. And globally, right? Everywhere, right? So like that's the other kind of thing that I'm interested in with my project is that in order to have this technology in the US, it actually involves a set of relationships with other countries. Because in the US, we do have some of the natural resources, like there is lithium in the US. It's actually not a very rare element. But in terms of the level of concentration and the quality of the deposits, I'm not convinced that we could like source all of our lithium within the US, right? If we wanted to have like a made in America battery, quote unquote, right? I don't actually think that's fully possible. Like some of those elements are gonna come from elsewhere in the world, especially in the near to medium term. So, you know, that brings up all sorts of interesting questions about trade, about how we cooperate with other governments, which are, again, important for the whole issue of climate change. But this is like a way in to kind of look at them concretely.
But so just as we, you know, energy is such an important factor in our international relations, green tech is going to be just the same way.
Exactly. I mean, I hope that the relations will be different than those that surround oil. I mean, which have been extremely conflictual, competitive, have obviously caused tremendous harm to local communities, as well as contributing to climate change. So, you know, the one thing that green technology and renewable energy has over oil is that it, not that there are no emissions, because there are still emissions with producing this technology and with the resource extraction, but it's obviously going to be much better for the emissions picture. But in terms of other things like the environmental impacts, but also the way in which governments interact with one another, some similar problems could arise. And so the question is, like, we're at an early stage of the transition, like, how can we do it much better than the fossil fuel kind of economy? And I think your last point in terms of, like, you know, we've seen how energy can factor into international relations, often badly. And so, you know, because it is, you know, it is obviously an extremely important element in terms of economic activity, right? And so, and also political control and political power. So it can pose all sorts of problems and challenges. And, you know, renewable energy hopefully won't replicate some of those, but it's still too early to tell.
Because, like, lithium, if you say it's a pretty common element, it doesn't sound like we're going to have an OPEC for lithium. Like,
That's a great. Did you just come up with that, or did you do some research for this interview?
I wish I could say I did more research for this.
No, but it's actually cooler that you just came up with it, because it's actually a very, very smart and very, like, relevant question. There are actually, you can Google afterwards if you're interested, if you search OPEC for lithium, there are articles about that. And the reason why is because some of the best deposits that we know about right now, of course, geologic knowledge is always changing and growing, and we could discover, you know, better deposits in the future. But for now, over half of the world's lithium is in Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile. And that's called by industry people the lithium triangle, because it's not really a triangle. Actually, I don't even know why it's called that, but it's, you know, three countries. So I guess there's three points. But they share, across their borders, they kind of share this climactic geologic zone that has lithium in it. And it's in all of those countries. Chile, the place that I did a few months of research, 4 months of field work, which we can talk about more if you want, has the most developed lithium sector of those three countries. But there has been talk both among policymakers in those countries, but also just by sort of analysts of the industry, that, like, maybe these countries will band together and form a lithium OPEC. And it's interesting because some people think that would be a bad idea. We could maybe see why, like, sort of like political machinations or price fixing or whatever. But some people in the industry actually think it would be a good idea to sort of make the sort of standards and regulations for investment and for environmental regulations, like, more standardized across the three countries. So, you know, I won't get into the weeds because that's a little bit wonky, but there could be, we'll see, we're such at an early stage of the process, like, there could be countries that have a lot of these mineral resources, you know, whether it's lithium or nickel or cobalt or whatever, that are needed for the green transition, potentially start to collaborate policy-wise, or maybe even in terms of, like, a cartel around prices. Who knows? There could be a lithium OPEC, and it's something that's actively being discussed by people.
And cartel has such, like, bad connotations, but it is what it is. It's, you know, it's just an organization to exactly work out all these discussions.
And a lot of these energy sectors, and especially oil, have really never been a free market. Like, way before OPEC existed, what we had was a cartel of private corporations. They were called, like, the seven major, like, the sort of seven sisters, like these seven big oil companies, many of which, all of which still exist today in different, with different names to some extent. But, like, the major oil companies that we know, like BP or whatever, they were part of this, you know, actual private sector cartel. And then with changes in the world system in terms of countries becoming sovereign and the end of sort of colonialism, you know, a lot of changes that happened over the 20th century, the OPEC in a way modeled itself off of this private sector cartel. But OPEC is a government, you know, is a multilateral government organization, but that plays some similar roles. So I think you're right. Like, you know, in a lot of sectors, there is forms of industry collusion. And in oil in particular, this has always really actually been how the oil industry is run, for better or worse, of course.
But that might be a good segue into talking about your travel to Chile. We'd love to hear about your field work. So you've already gotten to travel to sort of get started on.
I know, I got it in before. I feel like I like got a lot of travel in under my belt, both for field work and for some conferences, like right before it was now, you know, not doable anymore. So, you know, I'm adjusting to this new moment. But yeah, I had a great experience. I was a little nervous at first because I've spent for my prior book, like almost 2 years doing field work in Ecuador. So I really knew the place well. And you know, there's a comfort to going to a place that you have contacts and connections. And so I was a little worried, like Chile, I mean, I speak the language, but I had never been there before. And I just never done research there before, but I went and it worked out quite well. I was able to get a lot done thanks to PC's faculty, like pre-tenure research leave, which faculty senate won, I think, a few years before I was hired. And so that was allowed me to do this full semester of research. And then because of, you know, being a professor and I don't teach over the summers, so I was able to do more over the summer. And so it was quite substantive as like just a first kind of stint. And then over winter break, because I was invited to a conference, but I ended up tacking on research to it, I went to Europe. I was primarily in Brussels at a conference related to the EU, but I did research interviewing policymakers at the EU with how they think about all of these issues around green tech supply chains, which actually ended up in a sort of serendipitous way changing my project a little bit and making it more transnational. And I've also been interviewing over the phone and Skype some policymakers in the US. So I have a couple of different kind of field sites, but yeah, it's, you know, all that research was great. I'm happy to talk more about any aspect of it. Just to bring us up to the present, yeah, totally unsure how I will continue to do research. I have this very fortunate situation that you mentioned in the intro of having a couple fellowships that get me a couple of years of professional leave. So I'm hoping that in 2021, for example, or 2022 at the latest, like I will be able to do what I intended to do, which is return to Chile, but also go to China, which is a place that I'm sure it makes sense to that, you know, this makes immediate sense as a place where a lot of green technology is produced right now, right? You know, of course, hopefully in the future that those sectors will be more everywhere in the world, right? But for now, China is the place where they are primarily produced, and China is also a large consumer and refiner of these raw materials that are needed for. So that my plan this summer was to go to two CH countries, China and Chile, but that didn't work out. But I do think that I'll be able to do one or both of those in the period of my 2 year kind of fellowship period. And so for now, I'm just doing research that I can do from home, which is a lot of reading the news and academic research, and also doing interviews through phone and Skype, which works. You know, it's not the same as like embedded in-depth ethnography and like being in the place, but it's a good way to get what especially more elite or actors that are more easily to access from, you know, via Skype. You know, it's not like being in the local community per se, but it does give you a sense of the policy issues and just some of the economic issues and stuff like that in the sector.
So you were interviewing policy leaders in Brussels and you've been doing some in the US. Who were you hoping to chat with, or who were you speaking with in Chile and in China?
Yeah, in Chile, I had a whole mix of things. So I did 40-odd interviews while I was there in the 4 months. And it was a mix of policymakers in the public sector, like regulators and, you know, elected officials, people in working in the state or in the government, some private sector people. That was a little more challenging, which was interesting because in my prior research in Ecuador, interviewing people in the mining sector, it was not as hard to interview people at mining corporations. For whatever reason, I have some hypotheses, but I won't get into them now. It was a little more challenging in Chile, but I did manage finally to get some interviews at the big lithium corporations. So those were those. I also, in other parts of the private sector, like consultancies and people that work with the firms, though not in them directly, I interviewed those folks. And then I interviewed activists and academics and lawyers and scientists. And I'm grouping all those together because a lot of those people, as well as some of the environmental regulators for the government, were more skeptical of lithium, in some cases opposed to it or opposed to the way that it's happening now because of the impacts on the water system and other environmental issues. So I try to always get in my research like a broad set of actors, just because it makes it more interesting, and you can also see where ideas and conflicts, like how what the dynamics are and how they kind of affect different types of people and involve different types of people. So I usually have that kind of spread, and that was similar in Chile. And I did research as a result of this kind of sampling method, we might say. I did research both in the capital and Chile. Unlike the U.S., it's not a federal system; it's a unitary system. What that means is that it's quite centralized. All of the politics. It's not like in the states where like every state has its own, you know, governor and legislature and whatever. In Chile, it's very centralized in Santiago, sort of like France is super centralized in Paris. So if you want to know like what's happening politically, you need to do research in the capital. So I was there a lot, but I also went to the north of Chile, which is the region of the country directly affected both by all the lithium mining that exists in Chile, but also by copper sector, which is Chile's like supplies, I don't know if it's like 40%, some huge amount of the world's copper. Maybe it's a little lower than that, but it's a big copper exporter. So copper and lithium are actually happening in the same zone of Chile, and that accounts for some of the environmental impacts which both of these sectors have. But I went to the north, research communities a bit that are affected by lithium, spoke to local indigenous activists and environmental activists that are campaigning to make the sector better, or in some cases to oppose it altogether. And so that was very interesting. It's a very interesting region just in terms of the climate and the geography and the landscapes. And I had never been to a desert of that sort. I've been to the west of the U.S. I've been to a desert climate before, but this is like the second driest place on Earth after Antarctica. It's like a very extreme desert. So that was a cool place to do research, and also to just like do some nature travel and stuff like that.
It's interesting to think about the impacts on water in the second driest place on Earth if lithium mining.
Exactly. And that's the way you pose that question is exactly correct, right? So water is already a scarce resource, and it's scarce naturally. Like naturally this desert has a negative water balance, like more evaporates into the air because of how dry it is and sunny, then comes in through precipitation. That's how the ecosystem just works naturally. But then you can think about a huge copper sector, and copper, you need a lot of fresh water in order to process copper. So copper is a very water hungry industry. Then you have a lot of tourism. I was just explaining the landscapes. Like this area has exploded as one of the top tourism areas in Chile. It's like now like neck and neck with the Patagonia in the south, which is another big tourism region. And it has annual huge mega tourism because it's warm all year. You know, it's just like you can travel there all year. And it's beautiful. I understand why people want to go there, but the tourism industry is not super well regulated. So there's a lot of inefficient energy and water use that goes into some of these hotels and stuff. And then there's agriculture to some extent, and there's human communities that use water. They're not the main source of the issue, of course. It's more these sort of mega businesses and sectors that use a lot more water. But yeah, you're exactly posing it right. It's a water scarce and very water vulnerable kind of ecosystem. And so having these industries that by their nature kind of suck out a lot of water out of the ground is a real issue for the small scale farming that exists, and just for human access to water for drinking and, you know, for potable water.
Tourism usually requires swimming pools and spas and things like that. Right?
Exactly. So. I mean, it's sometimes like, just like sometimes the inefficient use of resources is like, why put a huge swimming pool in a desert? I mean, I don't know. You can go somewhere else in the country where there's natural water to swim in if you want to, but you know, people like their luxuries. So those things definitely exist, but I would say copper and then secondarily lithium are accounting for a lot of the impacts on water in the area, and has of course caused communities to varying degrees, depending on the community, to oppose or be critical of these processes. Of course, it's challenging because a lot of those community members may work in the mining sector, right? So sometimes families are torn between like opposing it or having their livelihood based on it. It's a complex, you know, I don't want to simplify because it's a complex issue, but there's definitely growing concern about the environmental impact. And I didn't even mention, silly, because it's you know, a motivation of my research, which is the climate change piece. So climate change is also affecting the desert region. We know that in desert or semi-arid regions of the world, drought, you know, desertification, like places that aren't deserts are becoming deserts, and places that are deserts are becoming drier. And so climate change itself is like increasing the drought susceptibility of the region. So it's a lot of impacts that are hard to disentangle, but lithium is the one that I'm focusing on more.
And so the people who are could potentially be working on lithium extraction are worried about the impact of, you know, so lithium could help with climate change, lithium batteries, but right. at the same time, the process could.
That's the comp. Exactly, exactly. And you could see how there could be better and worse governance models to deal with that, right? I mean, it's sort of like you can either just do, you know, rapidly extract lithium with no concern for the environmental impacts to serve a sort of global market. And not, you know, and sort of not involve community members or really even like policymakers that much in the process. Or you can have a process that takes stock of like, what are the impacts, maybe has a temporary moratorium, which is one of the things that some communities demand, like temporarily stop mining to just take a sort of survey of what the impacts on water are. There actually isn't good research even. So just kind of just have the research, have the community input and kind of go about it in a more sustainable way is an option. But unfortunately, the pressures of the market and of the businesses involved kind of make that better governance model more difficult to implement. But I'm hoping that, you know, it'll improve, of course, over time.
So, of course, as a professor at PC, research is just part of your work. One of the classes you taught in the spring was the politics of energy. And then I was intrigued because you go through the history of energy, you know, it's just a concept, yeah. all the way leading to the Green New Deal, which connects to your book, which you helped co-authored, A Planet to right. Win, Why We Need a New Green New Deal. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. And the sentence from Green New Deal, in the 21st century, all politics are climate politics. Just could you help unpack that?
Sure. First, I'll just to respond a little to the first part of your question about teaching. I really do enjoy, and it's a nice aspect of teaching at a liberal arts college and at PC in particular, that professors have a lot of autonomy over what they teach. So you can like change your courses, you can change the titles, you can create a new course, you can change the content, you know, and I've done that with especially this course has gone through three iterations. It started as the politics of resource extraction, and I did a lot of different resources. Then I zoomed in on more on oil and coal and gas. And so it was the politics of oil, but just made hydrocarbons or fossil fuels in general. And then I made it the politics of energy to address renewable energy. So it's gone through a couple of different phases on this class. And I've always enjoyed teaching it and learned a lot from it.
But you've only been teaching at PC since 2015. So that's gone through three iterations.
And I think I taught one of those twice. So I've taught this class almost like every year that I've been at PC in one version or another. And it's been sort of tracking my first book project and then my next project. And so I would say though, and I'm glad you brought up this politics of energy class, that it's the best example that I've had in my career at PC of a class that is like really new reading for me. And like, I'm learning a lot along with the students. I always learn from teaching. One always, even if you're teaching the same thing, you learn something because you have to figure out how to make it to connect to students or get some more context for yourself. But this was like really new stuff. And I was like a little worried, like, I hope this book is good that I have assigned, or like, I hope that this was the right way to organize it. And the students were just great. I love capstone classes because like our seniors are amazing. And you know, the poli sci, you know, I only have taught capstone in a poli sci setting, but our students are just, our majors are really great. So they worked through it with me and they were really wonderful. So I commend my capstone students, but yeah, I learned a lot from it. And I learned on both ends that actually pick up directly on your question. I learned a lot more about the history of energy as a scientific and sort of economic concept from the Industrial Revolution onward. And I learned a lot more about contemporary debates over renewable energy, right? And so the oil stuff and the coal stuff is stuff I was much more familiar with. But on either of those ends, I learned much more, and that was super helpful for my research. The all politics are climate politics thing is our like kind of bold statement, and it relates to my way I think about my research, which is that climate politics are not just sometimes what we think of them, which is like the Paris agreements. Like all the climate politics are in one view is like the very official realms of kind of elite negotiating and policymaking over like things like emissions or vehicle standards or things like that, right? And that can happen at the international level, like in the Kyoto or Paris agreements. It can happen, of course, nationally, though we've been pretty stalled on national climate legislation for several years now. Or it can also happen at the subnational level, right? Like California and New York are like great examples of like states that have taken a real lead in climate politics, like understood it as, you know, regulating carbon emissions through direct legislation that or regulation that does so. And that type of climate politics is super important. But what we were trying to say in the book is that every realm of human life has impacts on the climate, right? So it's how we drive to work. It's how our buildings are built. Are they energy efficient? You know, it's how many what type of work we do, what we're producing in our economy, how we consume, what we eat, how we grow our food, like literally everything and everything has an effect, even in a narrow sense, on carbon emissions. But then, of course, if you broaden it to other forms of environmental impact, there's all sorts of them. So that's kind of a, not negative, but a sort of like concerning way to phrase it, which is like everything we do has impacts on the environment. That's kind of scary and a big challenge. But a more politically productive kind of lesson to take from that is that there are all these areas of human life that that we can do interesting policymaking and also like civil society organizing around climate in ways that connect more to people's daily lives. Because I think the stuff with like the really high level elite like agreements, especially the international stuff, feels so distant. I mean, I'm a political scientist and I can barely understand some of the Paris Accord like agreement stuff and which country said what and why this was the, you know, way the clause was written and whether it has any binding effect. I mean, it's just very technocratic. But if we're saying like the building, the house you live in has climate impacts because of the energy it uses, because you have a gas stove or because the insulation is super inefficient. And like also some of those impacts impact your actual health, right? Like we actually know that gas stoves are bad for people's health. Like you're actually breathing in fumes. The energy efficiency piece like has impacts on your utility bill. Like I would love to live in a more energy efficient building because my utility bill would be lower, right? So there are very clear ways that like when you think about climate politics as something much broader and also much more immediate in the way it affects people, then you can come up with interesting policies and coalitions that deal with some of the economic issues and local health issues that we face and pollution issues at the same time that they address the proliferation and accumulation of carbon emissions in the atmosphere, right? And so bringing it home to people, bringing it to concrete kind of quote unquote bread and butter issues that people are very concerned about with their healthcare, with their housing, with, you know, access to transit and all that kind of stuff, it makes climate a more interesting and like concrete set of politics to work on. And so that's what we're getting at. We're getting at both like the impact of all these activities, but also the way that thinking more holistically about climate makes the politics actually more interesting and more relatable to everyday people.
So the discussions at the higher level can actually impact our day-to-day lives.
Exactly. For sure.
Well, so this was a very interesting semester, though, to deal with politics of energy. I mean, after students, you know, didn't come back from spring break, were you able to incorporate any of the conversations that were happening on the national level from current events into your courses?
Yes, absolutely. And it turned out that basically the courses that I was teaching, all of them, and maybe it's because I'm in political science, so I don't think it's like so random, but it just happened to be that all my courses were very easy to relate to the issues, but in different ways. So it's kind of, it's funny, I haven't totally reflected on this in an overall way until you posed this question, but I taught Latin American politics. So some of what we did there, I continued with the syllabus because I actually think the students wanted that structure. They didn't want me to just like scrap it and only focus on COVID, but they also didn't want me to ignore COVID, right? So I kind of kept with the syllabus, reduced the reading, reduced the expectations, did all the things that, you know, for everybody is good for our well-being in this crazy moment. But I added some stuff where I'd send them articles on like how different Latin American countries are handling it, which they found really interesting because it's a lot of countries. So it's, and you get an interesting comparative perspective on like, why did Brazil do so poorly and Uruguay and Costa Rica do so well, right? So we just read some news articles, discussed them a bit. And I also just in all my classes had like open discussion at the beginning of the pandemic of like, how's this affecting you? And, you know, so we would just chat about it in general, but we related it to Latin America. With the energy sector and the energy class, the fascinating thing that was happening that started before COVID but was accelerated by COVID was this total crash in the oil sector. So really, you know, it started because of these kind of elite politics in OPEC and in the world around like countries
with
and
Russia
their oil output
and Saudi Arabia,
exactly, Russia, exactly in the U.S. And so that began pre-COVID, but and was dampening the price a bit already and putting downward pressure on the price. But then with COVID, a collapse in demand, the price crash, and the whole sector is really in shambles right now. I mean, I don't want to overstate it because I think that, unfortunately, from my perspective, it's possible that with government help, there'll be some recovery in the oil sector. I hope that actually governments use this opportunity to phase out oil, but we'll see. But regardless, the industry is in real crisis right now. So that was something we were able to address in class discussions a bit, or I would send them articles and they had enough background knowledge to interpret it. And then the last class I taught is this model OAS class, so Model Organization of the American States, which is kind of like a UN of the Western Hemisphere that exists in reality. And we were doing a kind of model UN, but model OAS. And it's a class I love teaching. And that was the class that got impacted the most by COVID, because the whole point of that class is to go to DC eventually and collaborate with all these students from across the US and Canada and Latin America that are representing different countries. And it's really fun for them to have that, you know, real life kind of model experience, but that did not happen. So they worked through it emotionally and psychologically that they weren't going to get that, but we continued the class and the model went virtual. And so it's not like they didn't get it at all. They just didn't get it.
When did they usually go? Do they usually go for spring break or?
Actually over Holy Week.
Okay.
So like they do it. So, they do it that way because a lot of Latin American, it's mostly US, but there's some Latin American delegations and they have like school off then. So it's easier because their travel is a longer trip. And so it's easier for them to come to DC then. So we do it. So it's right around spring break, but not the same week. So they were disappointed by that, but they worked through it. But it was interesting to think about, again, COVID in the Latin American context and in sort of multilateral context and how, just thinking about the relation between these international institutions and COVID and cooperation between states and also disparities between states. And so all of my classes kind of were able to touch on it in ways that I think were instructive for, certainly for me and I think for the students as well.
Well, this is the one thing about your fellowships is that you don't have to debate what would be the best approach for the fall.
I can't say that I I'm missing those. I am trying to keep up with them because I think they're very interesting from a policy angle, like what the best thing to do is. And I also, out of solidarity with my colleagues that have to go through this, so I've been keeping up with them, not intervening as much since I'm not, you know, going to be a factor. I don't want to say lucky because again, I feel for all my colleagues, not just at PC, but elsewhere that have to deal with this. But I feel privileged, I guess I should say, to not have to be of the guinea pig sort of class of, you know, cohort of professors figuring out how to do this and contending with different options from the administration and whatever. But I'm hoping that by the time I return, in 2022, that there'll be some stability to the situation. But you know, I'm definitely keeping up with the news because I do think it's the news from PC internally and nationwide in terms of what educational institutions are doing, because it's very tricky, not just because it's so complex and there's so many factors, but because it's changing. Like every week, it's like, okay, now the U.S. is like back up, and it's just like a very hard situation to get a handle on from a campus perspective.
Without a doubt. Just, you know, there's no right answers. There's no blueprint of what we're supposed to do. But
no blueprint, sure.
Well, Dr. Riofrancos, this was a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed your questions a lot. They were thought-provoking. And so thanks for the conversation and the opportunity.
Subscribe to the Providence College Podcast in all the usual places, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. If you like what you hear, please review and share with others. Thanks for listening, and go Friars.